The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Catalysts for Change in Small Cell Lung Cancer, Optimizing the Use of Standard Therapies and Accelerating the Transition of Emerging Strategies to the Clinic. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/FUR860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Good morning. Thank you all for joining us this morning for Catalyst for Change in Small Cell Lung Cancer, Optimizing the Use of Standard Therapies and Accelerating the Transition of Emerging Strategies to the Clinic. I'm Taufik Owonikoko from the University of Maryland, Guinabam Cancer Center. And this morning, I'm joined by my colleagues, Dr. Anne Cheng from Yale Cancer Center and Dr. Jared Wise from the University of North Carolina, Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. Our goals for today are as follows. One, to equip you with the knowledge to make the most of the current therapies and expand their roles in small cell lung cancer. Enhance your awareness of new therapies showing promise in this disease and likely to impact practice soon. And augment your skills to develop individualized treatment plans for patients with small cell lung cancer. Why have we not made so much progress with this disease? While we've made some advances recently, there are still a lot of gaps and barriers to treatment advances in small cell. To a lot of our audience in person, as well as those online, we all recognize that this is a disease that is strongly correlated with smoking-related activities and therefore a lot of patient comorbidities. Rapid clinical course of the disease, not tolerance of treatment delays, therefore making it challenging for patients to be screened for participation in clinical trials. Standard chemotherapy are very easy to administer, therefore fewer referrals for patients to go on trials, and limited understanding of the biology of this disease. Of course, things are getting better, but inadequate preclinical models remains a challenge. The consequence of all these factors, we have a lot of failed randomized trials that could not meet their pre-specified endpoints. We've not been able to extend the survival for our patients in a meaningful way, especially in those being treated in the second line and beyond. But it's not all gloom and doom. What can we do in terms of what we currently have? So I will start off this session by just reminding all of us where we are and where we've been, and then my colleagues will take it on in terms of what we do for the more challenging aspect of this disease. So this is the CASPIAN study design, which has set the current standard for our patient in the front line. The highlight of this was a three-arm trial that was looking at anti-CTLA-4, anti-PD-L1 with chemotherapy, or anti-PD-L1 with chemotherapy alone versus chemotherapy alone. Three-arm trial. We are all very aware of the result of this trial, that the addition of durvalumab to chemotherapy resulted in better outcome for patients with meaningful improvement in overall survival, almost 30% reduction in the risk of death. But using anti-CTLA-4 along with durvalumab did not significantly improve outcome over durvalumab alone, so therefore that is not an option currently for our patient. And what we've learned from this trial is also that when you have patients with brain metastasis or without brain metastasis, the impact of adding anti-PD-L1 to chemotherapy was present. In those with metastasis at baseline and those without metastasis at baseline, the outcome was better with the addition of durvalumab to chemotherapy. In the IMpower133 study, similar design, only that this is just looking at atezolizumab plus chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone. Well-designed trial. We are also very, very aware of this study. And at the end of the trial, we saw significant improvement in overall survival from 10.3 months to 12.3 months, close to 25% reduction in the risk of death for those patients treated with chemotherapy and atezolizumab. But what is more important here is we have long-term follow-up from this trial now that is showing us that the benefit that we see with the addition of anti-PD-L1 to chemotherapy is really meaningful and durable. So this is the umbrella extension study of the IMpower133. Just quickly to walk you through this, at the end of the study design and close of the database, those patients on the atezolizumab arm who continue to benefit were actually rolled over into this extension study just to see how well they would do in long-term follow-up. While this was only a small subset of patients, about 18 patients total, This gave us a signal of what to expect. And the impressive thing about this is when you look at the overall survival at 5 years for this population of patients, it actually carried over from what we saw at 36 months. There was no significant attrition, suggesting to us that we actually may be curing some of our patients, but I don't think any one of us is brave enough to go there at this point. But historically, we know at 5 years, only about 4% of our patients will be alive if they only got chemotherapy. So seeing 12% being alive, it really, really is encouraging, and we need to figure out how to get many more of our patients into that cohort of patients making it to 5 years. And regardless of the site of disease, addition of immunotherapy to chemotherapy was beneficial. That trend was consistent against all sites of disease involvement, whether the primary lung site, nodal involvement, liver, brain, bone, or pleural disease. So this is very encouraging that we cannot use site of disease involvement to say that this is not going to work. And specifically, sanctuary site that we know, patient with brain metastasis, this is the most challenging subset of patient. Addition of atezolizumab to chemotherapy delayed intracranial progression in those patients. So this would not be a reason to say we do not want to use immunotherapy because somebody has brain metastasis. The benefit still applies to those. So with this backbone of what we currently consider to be our standard of care, what else can we do to get more of our patients into that tail of the curve so that we're not dealing with 12% at 5 years and hopefully we're dealing with 90% at 5 years? There are some emerging strategies and some ongoing studies that I'm going to just quickly review. One is, can the addition of radiation to immunotherapy help improve outcomes for patients with extensive stage disease? And we've not had a lot of data now in limited stage, but that is not for lack of trying. I think there are many trials poised to answer these questions and very soon. And one of them is the ADRIATIC. So the ADRIATIC trial is looking at the use of immunotherapy as consolidation strategy. Three groups, durvalumab and tremelimumab, durvalumab with placebo and placebo. This study is fully accrued. We continue to wait with bated breath for this to read out, and hopefully this year or next, we should have some data in this space. Similarly, the Alliance LU-005, combining atezolizumab concurrently with chemoradiation therapy followed by consolidation for 1 year versus standard chemoradiation. This is also fully accrued. The data is being cleaned up, and I'm very hopeful that we're going to get the results of this trial this year or at the latest, maybe next year, hopefully. Finally, consolidation thoracic radiation is not what a lot of us use, but we know that this is part of our standard of care approach in some instances. We've not had prospective data to show whether this is actually safe and beneficial in patients treated with immunotherapy. So the RAPTOR trial is looking at the use of consolidation thoracic radiation in those patients treated with atezolizumab maintenance and see whether we can further improve the outcome. So with that background, let's consider a case to sort of bring this home and make it real. So 80-year-old African-American female, a significant past history of hypertension, COPD, and hyperlipidemia, presented with fatigue, cough, and some weight loss for 3 months. Initial chest x-ray showed the left upper lobe opacity, 4 centimeter lobulated mass was found along with left hilar and mediastinal adenopathy on CT scan. Very anemic and thrombocytopenic. Bronchoscopy biopsy confirmed diagnosis of small cell. MRI was negative for this patient in terms of brain involvement. And PET CT confirmed widespread metastasis, including the liver, bone marrow uptake consistent with skeletal metastasis. Patient is now in your clinic to discuss further management. So newly diagnosed patient, widely metastatic, bone marrow involvement with hematologic compromise. Which first-line therapy would you recommend for this patient? So there are a lot of clinical factors to consider here, but I don't think any one of those would preclude the use of immunotherapy. But let me turn to my colleagues here around the table. So in terms of this patient, what would be your recommendation?
So I'll start.
80 years old.
Yeah. I'll start. This is actually my patient.
Yep.
And had a great performance status. And we decided to go with platinum etoposide and immunotherapy. I thought that this was important to highlight a few things. Performance status-wise, she was quite good. But if you have a patient who has poor performance status, and often these patients will show up in the hospital, This is a situation also blessed by the NCCN guidelines that you can actually treat them and their performance status, especially if it is thought to be due to the disease, which it often is, will improve. I think that, you know, I also put in that this patient is African-American to highlight the fact that we really need to increase these populations in our clinical trials. The Caspian trial had 3%. Other major trials, not to call them out, but there's major trials who really have very few patients from underrepresented populations. So I always keep that in mind as I'm trying to get my patients to go on trial. And then I thought that this also highlighted the fact that, and I thought I would share that, you know, there are patients with significant comorbidities, heart failure, patients with renal failure, and liver failure or liver issues that you're really thinking about how to adjust their treatment. And so I just thought I would share that for patients, I have had several patients with significant heart failure, and we were able to use a Topifos, for example, and really concentrate the volume into about 250 cc's to make it easier and not volume overload them. And I have patients that are on hemodialysis where they get, for example, dialyzed Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and we'll treat them on Thursday, skip a day, and do Saturday and Sunday. So there are ways to really get through this. And actually, they have very good performance mm-hmm. status. They yeah. do well. Yeah. So,
yeah, I think really one thing that this case is highlighting is age should not be a barrier to treatment. And I know that Jared is very, very interested in what we do for those with compromised performance status. You know, how do we get from here to there? But this is not that patient. And based on the data available, we know that the addition of immunotherapy to chemotherapy does not worsen the safety profile of chemotherapy alone. So there would not be any contraindication to using immunotherapy along with chemotherapy just because of the patient's age. But let me turn to you, Jared, in terms of, for this patient, treatment naive, the anemia, the thrombocytopenia, is there any concern for you in terms of your choice of agents to use or how you sequence your treatment?
Yeah, so you know, if you look at the side effects of carboplatin etoposide, either alone or with atezo or durva, and I would say the same of topotecan, I would say the same of lurbinectedin, what we see as a theme for all of our cytotoxic agents is that myelosuppression and the downstream sequelae of myelosuppression are the most common side effects. And I think we have a certain learned helplessness around this because we didn't have a choice for decades, right? This was just the cost of doing business. And if you didn't want the patient to suffer horribly of their cancer, you had to accept the certain amount of suffering you were going to cause. But we do actually have an agent that can help with that. And so I agree this patient should not be excluded from treatment by age or comorbidities. But I would say there is a new supportive care drug, trilaciclib, that could be considered for this patient. And if this patient were treated in my practice, they would receive that agent to help with some of that myelosuppression.
Thanks for that insight.
Tofiq, what about yes. liver dysfunction? Do you want to talk about that? I put that in because she had a little, her thrombocytopenia.
Yeah, so since this was your patient, how did you manage the use of chemotherapy with elevated liver function? Yep. Do you dose reduce? Do you drop an agent? Do you power through?
I think, you know, when we wanted to sort of focus a little bit on clinical management,
yeah.
I do think in this patient, and you would consider some dose reduction, and
yeah.
we did.
Yeah.
She did really well with that. I think thrombocytopenia or liver dysfunction, especially if you're thinking that it's due to the disease, we go ahead and treat, and she did fine.
That's great. So with that, I will turn this over to Dr. Cheng to take us through what we do beyond the front line.
Great, thank you. All right, so beyond the front line, we certainly consider platinum doublet rechallenge, and let's start there. This was the phase 3 trial that looked at patients who had a chemo-free interval of 90 days versus topotecan, and the slide or the panel on the left shows you the PFS for combination chemotherapy was 4.7 months, PFS versus topotecan 2.7 months. With a hazard ratio of 0.57. So this is really the basis of why we do consider a platinum doublet rechallenge versus topo. On the right, that's the overall survival graphs, and you can see those are identical. But it's important to remember that about 40% of those patients did cross over to the chemo combination chemo arm. Okay. What about topotecan? Not my favorite drug, but it certainly is one of the two FDA-approved agents. Topotecan can be given either 2.3 milligrams per meter squared PO for days 1 to 5 every 21 days. And that's the classic trial on the left from Dr. Mary O'Brien, showing topotecan benefit over best supportive care. And then on the right, topotecan IV, 1.5 milligrams per meter squared, days 1 to 5 every 21 days. Although I'll have to say, because of myelosuppression, that sometimes ends up being every 28 days. And that was versus CAV, and you can see that performed just as well. And that eligibility showed that the platinum-free interval was at least 60 days. Topotecan toxicities. This is hard to see close up, but basically PO and IV are very similar. And we talked about it's myelosuppression. The non-hematologic toxicities are 7% or below. And the panel also shows you that most of these non-hematologic ones are grade 1, 2. In terms of the grade 3 and 4 toxicities for the myelosuppression, you have all lines affected: leukopenic, neutropenic, thrombocytopenic, and anemic. So it's interesting when reviewing this data, oral seems to be a little bit better than IV in some cases and vice versa. But in general, I think you need to be prepared to dose reduce and also give the growth factor support in different ways. Okay, I'll turn to lurbinectedin, which is our second FDA-approved drug in this for a relapsed small cell. Lurbinectedin, the rationale is that, you know, obviously small cell is a very actively proliferating disease with genomic alterations. Lurbi binds to the DNA promoters, and you can see that purple in the right-hand side. It basically prevents binding of transcription factors to allow, and also specifically in the tumor-associated macrophages, you can see that it prevents tumor proliferation, matrix remodeling, angiogenesis, immune suppression. Also causes RNA Pol II degradation. So the phase 2 basket trial of lurbinectedin as a single agent, these are patients with PS 0 to 2. They had one prior line. They were allowed to have immunotherapy, and this did exclude CNS mets. And these patients received lurbi 3.2 milligrams per meter squared every 3 weeks. And I won't go into the statistics. Here's the efficacy results. And the column with the orange bubble there is resistant disease versus in the blue, it's sensitive disease. And basically the PFS was, the median PFS for resistant disease was 2.6 versus 4.6 months, and the overall survival 5 versus 11.9. And the duration of response, I think, is really notable with 6.2 months in sensitive disease and 4.7 months in resistant disease. And the swimmer's plot does show you that mostly the platinum-sensitive folks did better, but there are also some that had a shorter, some that were resistant that did well as well. In terms of safety for lurbinectedin, it's mostly the neutropenia that we watch, but this is in the level of 25%, 20-25%, grade 3, grade 4, and again, compared to topotecan, that was up in this 50-60% range for grade 3, 4. Very well tolerated by my patients. Fatigue, they do sometimes see, and you can see some LFT dysfunctions. So the phase 3 Atlantis trial, this was a phase 3 randomized trial, and it basically randomized patients to doxorubicin plus lurbinectedin. Note that dose was 2 milligrams per meter squared in combination with chemo to mitigate some of the possible cytotoxicity versus dealer's choice topotecan versus or CAV. Now, it's important to note that the patients who had the combination doxorubicin-lurbinectedin There were 50 patients that went on to have monotherapy after 10 cycles, and that was at the dose of lurbi, the full dose of 3.2 milligrams per meter squared every 3 weeks. If you look at the results, Atlantis was a negative trial. It did not meet the primary endpoint. The median overall survival was 8.6 months with lurbi doxorubicin versus 7.6 months in the control arm. And the thought was that really this is likely because of the dosing issue with the combination dose initially being lower than the 3.2. And if you look at the single agent post hoc analysis in that panel on the left, it shows you that the patients who originally had a CR, three patients, and when they went on to monotherapy, they continued to have a CR. They had a PR, 26 patients, 15 of those continued to have a PR or had a CR, three of those patients. And then the patients with stable disease, actually there were eight that remained stable, two who then went into a PR, one who had a CR, and the rest had PD. So I think this is really important. The thought here is really that the dose level is key here, it's important not to dose reduce in clinical practice as well. Okay, and then briefly, we'll talk a little bit about lurbinectedin, the ongoing future trials. Here's the LAGOON trial that's ongoing, phase three. It's lurbinectedin 3.2 versus lurbi 2 plus irinotecan, and then the dealer's choice institutional, either TOBO or irinotecan. And that'll be very interesting to see. This is the LUPER study. This is a phase 1-2 study that looked at Pembro plus Lurbi. And this shows you basically the waterfall plot, if you look, that there's really some nice efficacy there. I think that it's important to think about how this is be placed in clinical practice. A lot of these patients have been having chemo plus IO. And so the thought is really be nice to see that combination of lurbi plus IO effective so that we can continue that for our patients. And again, here the safety analysis, the most common grade 3-4 treatment-related adverse events, around 20% neutropenia. IMforte, this is a first-line lurbinectedin in combination with atezo in the maintenance setting. Also looking forward to the results of that. And then coming back to the NCCN recommendations for second or third-line therapy, again, consider dose reduction or growth factor support for patients with lower performance status. Preferred regimen is clinical trial so we can get patients better therapies and improved outcomes. Certainly considering retreatment with platinum doublet in the 6 month range as it was consensus, but also consider that for patients in the 3 to 6 months range if they look really good. And then the other recommended regimens are lurbinectedin and TOPO as we discussed today. So the case continues. Patient was successfully initiated on platinum doublet plus Durva. She completed 4 cycles of induction chemo immunotherapy with some delays in initiating cycle 3 and 4 because of delayed counts. She transitioned to Durva maintenance. The routine restaging scans after 7 cycles of monthly maintenance durvalumab unfortunately showed multiple new and progressive hepatic lesions. Her MRI of the brain showed 4 subcentimeter parenchymal lesions, and her PS actually remained preserved, and she wants to explore other therapeutic options. So this gets exciting. Assume that there's not a clinical trial available for her. Which treatment would you recommend for her next? Faculty, we're going to turn to you. Now, it's 7 months. What do you think about the length of that chemo-free interval when you manage your patients? And what are other things that you consider in that?
Yeah, I can have a crack at that. I think this is what we all face in the clinic. You know, you have a patient who has done very well and now you have to intervene again. I generally, at this point, consistent with the NCCN guideline, I put everything on the table. And the first thing for me would be, how well did the patient tolerate that frontline chemotherapy doublet? If they struggle through that, you know that re-challenging the patient with that same regimen is just going to be problematic. I think that's an easy decision to make. I would probably go with single-agent lurbinectedin for those with growth factor support, so I do not have to dose reduce. If the patient did very well and you have significant chemotherapy-free interval of 7 months like this, then I want to look at the patient and say, we have many options, and what is my best opportunity to get everything in for this patient to make sure that they benefit from it? So that would be where I would consider re-challenge with platinum doublet. But the question that we're going to maybe get to would be, what do you do with the immunotherapy if you decide to do that? And I think it's data-free zone. But, you know, I would defer and like to hear what Jared would do in that regard. But for this patient, I think my inclination would be to re-challenge with doublet first, even though he's 80 years old, but did very well with the frontline treatment.
So I couldn't more strongly agree with NCCN that the best treatment of this patient is to offer them a clinical trial. I would personally say ideally a UNC clinical trial, but if one isn't available, University of Maryland or Yale would be just fine.
Good.
I think we imagine that there's magical regression discontinuities at the points that trials define them, whereas in reality, our data doesn't support that. So in Europe, chemo treatment-free interval of 90 days was called platinum refractory, should have been really chemo refractory. In the U.S., we've used 6 months. This is really not, there's no discrete change at either of those intervals. The longer the patient has been chemo treatment free or cytotoxic chemo treatment free in the modern era, the greater my enthusiasm for putting them on retreatment. And I very much agree with you. I think the factor you mentioned of how well they tolerate it is too much ignored in the real world and is absolutely critical here, right? Quality of life is while we do this. This patient was 7 months. That's in a realm where if they tolerated well the first part, I would also prefer platinum retreatment. We are in a data-free zone with regards to the continuation of immunotherapy, but I think the burden is on us as clinical trialists, or if you prefer, put the burden on industry. But the burden is on those of us who do trials to define a benefit to keeping a patient on a drug past progression, not the other way. And so at the current standard of time, I would not continue the immunotherapy. I would treat the patient with platinum, but I retain equipoise as new data emerge that may be wrong.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, Lurbi actually did very well with patients with platinum-sensitive disease with the overall response rate of about 45%. I think we really rely on it in the patients who did not who have platinum resistance disease because topotecan performs so poorly there. So I agree with the approach. This is a marathon, so we're going to try to get our patients as many tools as they possibly can get. So I personally retreated with the platinum doublet and I stopped the immunotherapy.
Yeah, I would add another point. Lurbi is absolutely not wrong here. The data in those patients looks good. Our topotecan comparison trial did not show a difference in survival, granted a lot of differences there. The point I would add, though, is that Lurbi is not wrong, but if you use it, there's nothing wrong with considering coming back to that platinum doublet later. I think people forget that in real practice. That, you know, so if the patient gets the triplet up front, they do well, they get Lurbi. If you don't have a trial for that patient and they want more therapy and they're still showing chemosensitivity, you can consider coming back to that doublet or if you prefer a different doublet at a subsequent time point.
And the other factor here that we should also point out, and that's related to one of the questions online, is if we remember in the basket Lurbi trial, patients with brain metastasis were excluded. This patient progressed and there were new brain lesions. So that would also be a reason why one might say he does not fit that, you know, population of patients that went on Lurbi. So having said that, there is a question online, does lurbinectedin work in patients with brain mets?
I don't think we have the data for that.
So I've experienced that it can. We're all taught in training that cytotoxic chemotherapy doesn't work in the brain. And then we all learn in practice that it can, and we have some data sets exploring that further. Any chemo can work in the brain. And this specific case was a patient of asymptomatic, sub-centimeter, without a lot of edema. You didn't mention bleeding. I think the key point isn't that you have to radiate or not. I think you can defer radiation if you want to in such a patient and offer whatever you think is optimal systemic therapy. We should talk about what that is for a patient with brain mets. The key point, though, is that whatever you choose, you have to monitor the brain aggressively if you're not treating it. especially in small cell. But I think it is worth a conversation, and maybe I'll push the question back because I don't think I've asked one yet. In a patient with brain metastases, do you particularly favor irinotecan or temozolomide for these patients or some other agent?
My preference, that would be one area where, number one, for patient convenience. Secondly, because we know there's some track record of temozolomide getting into the brain, I tend to go with temozolomide in those patients, especially if it's significant brain involvement and we cannot otherwise control it effectively with targeted radiation approaches.
Yeah, I think that if the patient is on immunotherapy and that's the only site where there's progression, then I would follow the oligometastatic or oligoprogressive paradigm. Do, for example, gamma knife and continue the immunotherapy. But the second time that happens, I usually switch over to temozolomide. And I do think it's important also to mention here that you need to have a conversation with your patient about best supportive care in the future. They need to be prepared that at every treatment decision, even initially when I talk to my patient with this disease, I remind them of the journey that at some point in time it won't make sense to do further chemotherapy or treatment, and we really want to focus then on the quality of life. All right, this is a different patient, 60-year-old female who presented with limited stage small cell, treated with platinum etoposide and concurrent radiation. 4 months after completion of the chemotherapy, she had 3 new liver lesions and a new right adrenal metastases that are about 1 centimeter each. The liver biopsy was positive for disease, and she's asymptomatic. So again, assuming that there's not a clinical trial for this patient, which treatment should you recommend for her next? So I'm looking forward to the discussion of this question, our faculty, because again, this comes up every week for me.
Yeah, so I think this is actually a very, very difficult one. It seems straightforward, but not so straightforward, because you have someone who's not so platinum sensitive, but they've not been exposed to immunotherapy. And in the absence of a clinical trial where they would have that opportunity, you know, this would be your typical patient made for lurbinectedin if they were not starting with limited stage and they haven't had immunotherapy. So I'm sort of torn between, there is no right or wrong answer here. I think you have to look at the patient and see what's best. I would put both on the table. Single agent lurbinectedin could be reasonable because the patient progressed so quickly. And we know for those who are platinum insensitive, you really cannot salvage them with immunotherapy by itself. But I don't think it's wrong. The patient is 60 years old. If they really have good performance status with the same idea of, let's figure out a way to expose our patient to all the potentially beneficial agent, I might consider the use of platinum doublet with immunotherapy to see, but I would be very, very quick, you know, to stop that adventure if I know that it's not helping the patient. But I think both options here, for me, I have equipoise between lurbinectedin single agent or rechallenge with immunotherapy. What?
Agreed. Dr. Weiss, your thoughts, and also then what happens if it's just in the brain? So go ahead.
So I also have equipoise, and I congratulate those who said they don't know, because I don't either. All of these answers were reasonable. I, of course, have biases, as we all do, but I don't know that I'm right. I think that historically in solid tumor oncology, especially in lung cancer, we've never had an interaction between the sequence and timing of treatment and survival, right? As long as you were exposed to a good therapy, it worked as well early or late until we got to immunotherapy, where both our correlative data and our human trial data suggest that if you're to derive benefit, you're more likely to derive dramatic benefit the earlier that it's given. And that, to me, creates a bias that, together with the bias of obviously favoring less toxic therapies, to prefer an immunotherapy-containing regimen for this patient at this time. Should that be single-agent immunotherapy? Should that be chemo-immunotherapy? I don't know.
And what about the brain?
So the brain, the brain is a little different, right? When you have progression in the brain, we don't know, is it a biological resistance or is it a failure of adequate penetration of our agents? And that certainly influences thinking. Influences thinking in favor of considering a local approach to the brain with stereotactic radiosurgery, right? These tend to not be very morbid. These tend to be very well tolerated by patients. And then to push you to say you may still have a sensitivity to what was already done.
Yeah, I think here, if you have isolated progression in the brain, I think local directed therapy would be the way to go. But in this situation where you have both systemic and brain progression, SRS would be appropriate to a sub-centimeter brain met, not symptomatic. And then after that is done, then switch your preferred option of systemic therapy, whatever that is.
Great. I think we'll let, now you're up, Dr. Rice.
Are we sure?
Yeah.
So thanks to all the stalwarts who are here this early in the morning and caring about small cell. And thanks for my colleagues for letting me have the fun part of the talk, the new stuff. So Dr. Wanakoko mentioned that a lack of biologic understanding of small cell has long hampered progress in our research. And a major recent advance is the subtyping of small cell based on differential expression of transcription regulators. These include ASCL1, NeuroD1, and POU2F3, and then controversially, a fourth subtype defined either as lacking these or having YAP1 expression, differentially called inflamed or the Y subtype. Recently, we have data from Empower 133 sliced in two different ways, looking at the difference between the association of differential gene expression and survival, or in terms of long-term survival. Critically, though, when we look at this data, we have to remember that 133 was a study not just of immunotherapy, but of chemoimmunotherapy. But nonetheless, starting on this data at the far left, the heat map shows, I don't expect you to read these off the slide, no matter where you're sitting, but you can see at a glance from the colors that you do have four sort of discrete biologic themes here. And then moving to the middle of the slide, we see that in Empower 133, in immunotherapy-treated patients, there was a clear survival difference for the inflamed subtype patients, but not so much for the chemo-treated patients. Now, this is the ISLAC Targeted Therapies meeting, and Fred Hirsch is sitting here in the front. And so the question is always, what is the biomarker, right? We want, but what's a good biomarker, right? We need biomarkers that tell us what to do in the clinic. Yes, the inflamed patients treated with immunotherapy had the greatest survival here, but there was a benefit for the addition of atezolizumab regardless of subtypes. And so this is not something to be used to select or exclude patients from our existing immunotherapy at this time. Sliced and diced another way, the data shows the similar finding. At least numerically, there was more long-term survival in immunotherapy treated patients. So Caspian looked at the data by both methods, the Rudin and the Gay method. To me, one of the more interesting things with this was that the Y and inflamed subtype mostly correlated, but the findings were as a whole similar to 133, that there was a big advantage to having an inflamed or YAP subtype if you're immunotherapy treated, but not so much in the treatment with chemotherapy. But are the subtypes the best way to slice and dice patients? In Caspian, there was an association with improved survival for a high level of T-cell inflamed signature. Here, I think we have to contrast our biology and its impact on clinical choices with oncogene-driven adenocarcinoma. Even there, we've learned in recent years that things are not as clean as discrete buckets as we liked. We talk about isoforms now, we talk about co-mutations now, but nonetheless, in the small cell world, we have to be jealous of that discrete biology and ask what is the most useful to us in segregating patients. And this study is heavily influential in this thinking. In patients and in cell lines, this study found that the YAP1 subtype was associated with high T-cell inflamed gene expression profile signature, which in turn was associated with better prognosis even in the absence of immune checkpoint blockade. So could it be that subtype isn't the core driver, but rather it's more about an inflamed biology? Further evaluation of this idea was needed from a study of patients treated with immune checkpoint blockade. And CheckMate 32 provided that opportunity. I'll remind you that CheckMate 32 was a study of patients treated with Nevo or Ipi plus Nevo. This analysis defined the subtypes very simply. The transcription marker that was the most expressed. And when looked at in this manner, there were no significant differences by transcription subtypes. But the subtypes did differ from each other. So when you look at inflammation signature by subtype, there was a trend towards higher levels of the inflammation gene signature in the Y tumors at baseline versus the other subsets. When looked at across data, the YAP1 expression did correlate with inflammation signature. And I think perhaps most interestingly, there was a greater antigen presentation machinery signature in the Y subtype. The authors made some interesting hypotheses in this study. They proposed that instead of the different small cell lung cancer subtypes evading immune surveillance through different elements of the antigen presentation machinery, that perhaps instead there's a co-expression network with shared epigenetic mechanism. And they noted that LSD1 and EZH2 had been previously nominated as possible key epigenetic regulators, therefore looked at them. LSD1 was indeed correlated with poor survival in CheckMate 32, and there was a trend for EZH2. So now we get to something that you're probably going to see in clinic within the next year, and that is very exciting. And so as a theme here, we're looking at the actioning of surfosomic markers. And I want to contrast this to the kind of biology, kind of immunobiology that we're all using in the clinic every day with atezolizumab and durvalumab. When you give an immune checkpoint blockade agent, you're working on the immunopeptidome side of the house. So you're talking about neoantigens that are presented by HLA that T cells can recognize in this context. T cells are great killers, right? So when that works, that's great. The problem is that T cells cannot recognize surfosomic elements, foreign elements on the surface of the cancer cell that are not HLA presented. Antibodies can recognize those, but antibodies are not the great killers that T cells are. And so what we have here are two technologies to bring the power of T-cell killing to a surfosomic target. And so in the case of BiTEs, you have a bispecific antibody. One side binds your target of interest, say DLL3 here. The other side binds CD3, brings them together, and you get nice killing by the T-cell. In the case at bottom, you have a CAR. And what a CAR does, you genetically modify a patient's own T-cells so that in addition to being able to be activated by their native TCR, that can also be activated by this construct that can bind the surfosomic target. It's a fragment of an antibody hanging off a T cell that can lead to T cell activation. And what's cool about this is it's a living product. The patient gets to keep it forever, and you can add bells and whistles to it. Here's the phase one of the DLL3 BiTE tarlatamab. We have a 23% response rate in heavily pretreated patients. And when we moved to phase two, there was a look at two doses, the 10 and 100 milligram doses. The 10 milligram dose was chosen to take forward, and so I'll focus on it. There we have a response rate of 40% in third line plus extensive stage small cell. Beyond being an impressive number, it's the first genuinely different mechanism of action we've seen in some time. And I guess we're at a targeted therapies meeting. This is a targeted immunotherapy, right? A term that we haven't gotten to use much before. The PFS is much more impressive if you look at the tail than look at the median, but nonetheless, the median numbers are indeed favorable here, as are the survival numbers. Now, this brings up a novel class of toxicity for us in addition to a novel mechanism. And that is that you're looking at similar problems that we see with cellular therapy, most notably cytokine release syndrome. So this is an inflammatory syndrome, and cellular therapy, it can be quite severe. But here I think we have to draw a contrast, if you dig into these cases, between what we see with CAR, and for those who are used to it from the hematologic world, to what we've seen here. So what do you see? You see fever, you see hypoxia, but not big bad hypoxia that you're intubating people for, mostly treated with oxygen. And you see hypotension, but you're not talking about multiple pressors in the ICU here. You're mostly talking about hypotension dealt with fluid boluses. So there are complex logistics around this. It is a more difficult agent to administer, but I think surmountable. Tarlatamab has a high probability of being approved in the next year. It is not the only DLL3 agent. There are multiple other bispecifics with interesting and different mechanisms of action that I don't have time to delve into. There is also a DLL3 CAR under development. DLL3 is not the only surface omic agent to have agents. There are two others. Not shown here is SEZ6, but I will talk about GD2, the third target here. This has already had some evaluation in the clinic. And I bring it up as an example of a CAR therapy here. There is a phase one therapy of a GD2 CAR that is ongoing. And as I mentioned, the cool thing, one of the cool things about cars is that you can add bells and whistles to them. In the case of this construct, the bell is IL-15, which can help the product to expand. And the whistle, I think, is really cool, is that you is a kill switch. So that if you're, we know that cellular therapy can have significant harm to patients. In addition to the usual management strategies, if you don't like what's going on, you can kill the product off. And so that with that, we'll move to our expert panel discussion. And Dr. Wanakoko, I'm going to start with you because I presented some of your data there. I'm not intimidating at all, by the way, to do that. But what are you excited about here? Where do we move to next, right? How do we take some of our cool correlative data on these subtypes and bring them to patient benefit?
Yeah, thank you for that question. And I think we're all very excited, but we want to also be level-headed in terms of where we are. We have signals right now of things that we potentially could pursue prospectively. We only have retrospective data set. But I think what is most encouraging is we have consistent data set across trials showing that there is a biology of small cell that we potentially could build on as a way to identify patients for specific therapies, and in this case, for immunotherapy-based strategy. So I'm a glass half full person when it comes to this strategy. I do believe that we all have to apply ourselves and take the risk, just like we've taken the risk with targeted therapies with non-small cell lung cancer with small cell, that we have to take the risk for the benefit of our patient of how do we use this information prospectively, either to design trial or to try to understand the results of the trials that we're designing. So even if we do not specifically enroll all patients based on these trials, I think we need to be systematic to have prospective plan to understand the results as they emerge from some of these ongoing trials.
Yeah, I'll build on that. So in the audience, I just saw there's Dr. Karim. She had the S19, the SWOG-1929 trial. That was the first trial that showed a biomarker-directed approach with the Schlafen-11 positive patients getting maintenance therapy. It was a positive trial. Through SWOG, and we're very excited about this, it's awaiting final approval, but we have the SWOG-2409, the PRISM trial. And this is going to collect tissue, as you said, prospectively from patients, and then depending on what subtype they are, in combination with Schlafen-11 status, where the patients will go to whichever cohort of the biomarker-directed therapy versus IO versus IO. And I think that, you know, this is a starting point, S1929 showed us that we can actually do this feasibly. We can collect tissue during the induction therapy and then use that to guide us in the maintenance therapy. And I think that'll be a big step forward for our field.
And
so stay tuned for that next year.
Related to that is a question from the audience, which is, is there a rationale for using immunotherapy again in later lines after progression on chemo IO in the first line setting? And do you think any of these biomarkers could help in that regard?
Yeah, I think that I'll take that one.
Please.
In terms of, we already saw, and I presented that data for Lurbi plus Pembro or Lurbi plus Atezo. And I think that the idea of continuing the immunotherapy continue to challenge the immune system is a very attractive one for our patients. I think it's hard to stop that when you go to the second line therapy. So I agree with the person online who asked that question.
And I know we are running short on time now. One other question that came through is the impact of low dose CT scans on small cell lung cancer. Are there numbers or data to suggest that this is helpful for a patient with small cell?
There's data to argue that it may be a little less helpful there. So I'll remind everyone that low-dose CT screening is an annual affair. And small cell is just very, very fast, right? To catch small cell, you'd have to scan much more frequently. So in our major trial leading to the current standard of care, there was some small cell picked up. But if you really wanted to screen for small cell, it would have to be a lot more frequent than annual.
Love to be able to do that by blood, for example.
Yeah.
But that's still experimental idea.
And finally, can PCI be avoided after offering immunotherapy with chemotherapy?
PCI can just be avoided. We can stop there. So, you know, PCI had an interesting history, right? So it became standard of care through a European trial that did not mandate brain MRI at the beginning of therapy. And so what probably happened on that trial is that a third of the patients had brain metastases undiagnosed at the beginning of the trial. And so a randomized trial was conducted of treating brain metastases versus letting them grow. And of course, it's better to treat them than to let them grow. When we finally got a randomized trial that did MRI up front, that was a negative trial. There was even evidence of harm. And so I think we can actually really put PCI to bed and say that it is not the appropriate thing to do in extensive stage disease. But I think if we wanted to turn this back to a discussion point for practice, I might ask the question, okay, if we're not doing PCI, how often are we imaging the brain in patients who don't have brain mets at the beginning? What is the appropriate scanning interval?
I think we're doing it every 3 months, MR, and I think that trial also supported doing surveillance every 3 months. So far, that's been pretty successful with a few fights with insurance, but that's worked. I don't know if you
Yeah, that's been my practice as well, but that's not based on any data. I think we're all doing it out of intuition of, you know, we do everything every 3 months, so let's do it. But I do believe that the ENERGY trial would help us answer that question of PCI versus observation in appropriate patient where you can serially monitor the brain. So
I'm also doing every 3 months, so either we're wrong together or we're doing something logical. Any other questions from there?
So last question, I think in the interest of time, would be, what are you most excited about among the investigational therapies, and do you see true potentials for ADCs?
And you're looking at me. All right. Well, I'm standing in the hot seat. It's only fair. I think that it's easy to look far to the distant future. And I hope that one day we can cure extensive stage small cell in the distant future. But this is CME, right? So let's think about what's going to impact practice in the immediate term. And I think that it's not hard to see that there's a likely approval, and I'm deeply speculating, but there's a likely approval for tarlatamab in the summer of this year. This is public knowledge. And I think that that's going to have a real impact on patients in the here and now. And if we're to project farther forward, I think that that theme of targeted immunotherapy against preserved surfaceomic targets, if done right, could have the potential for more dramatic benefits.
Yeah, I'll just say, you know, the tumors, small cell tumors are cold tumors. They don't have a lot of T cells infiltrating. And so approaches that allow you to target whatever it is, the immune system, a molecule of chemotherapy to the tumor cell, I think are going to be helpful. I think ADCs look pretty good in this space as another option for our patients. And I'm hopeful that, you know, in TTLC 2028, we'll have a whole session on targeted therapies for small cell.
Well, thank you, everyone.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peer Review Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerreview.com/FUR860. This activity is supported by independent medical education grants from AstraZeneca and Jazz Pharmaceuticals.